This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and Alex Knight, with special guest, Aline Sims. So, a couple of links from Michael today. Sounded like you had a few other topics that you wanted to talk about.
There is a new Castlevania spiritual successor on Kickstarter. The producer of Castlevania, Koji Igarashi, left Konami, much like everyone at Konami, apparently, these days. And he's doing a Kickstarter for a not Castlevania, but still totally Castlevania game called Bloodstained: Ritual of the Night.
I'm holding back a shriek. This is amazing. Are you kidding me?
I know. And the best part, if you back it now, you get the choice of a sword or a sword whip. But that's it. That's if you get the special backer edition physical copy for $65. And the main character is a woman.
Well, that's interesting news.
It's taking all my willpower not to watch the video right now.
I haven't seen it yet, but yeah, this is pretty great. I am severely tempted to back it.
So why is Castlevania popular? I haven't played any of the games, so. Like, I don't count playing for 10 minutes as, like, I've played a Castlevania game, because I bought one of the PSP ports to the Vita that they released, and I've, over the years, I've tried a couple of them just for, like, very, very short period of time, and so I don't get why people are excited about it.
Was it Symphony of the Night?
I don't know. I played some PSP port and I gave up on it because I'm finding as I try to replay old games, I have very little patience for games that don't allow me to save frequently. So like I'm playing this game and I get like 3 lives and then I die and have to start from the beginning. Yeah, I'm not touching that. Sorry.
Castlevania is usually somewhat generous with the save areas. Like there's the different maps in the castle, and then there's usually a few save rooms. There's usually one before the boss, one at the start of the area, and one midway through if it's more forgiving.
I don't know. All I know is when I was playing this, I had to start from the beginning. I don't know, maybe I missed the save slot. I don't know, I didn't like it. It pissed me off and I stopped playing. So,
and all I'm thinking is, so I've got the Sega Genesis hooked up in the living room and I have Castlevania Bloodlines, and I'm like, maybe I don't want to record a podcast tonight and I'll just go play Castlevania for like an hour.
Is that, I actually have a Genesis. Is there a good Castlevania game for it?
The only one I have is Bloodlines. I don't know if there was another one that came out on the Genesis. I don't think there was.
No, I think that was the only one. That was the one that sort of experimented with 3D.
Oh my gosh, it's been so long since I played, I don't really remember, but, like, the Genesis was the only gaming system I had growing up, so I, yeah, this is my game.
Oh, okay, this one, Eric Lacard.
Yeah. And I never got very far.
Aline, I think you and I were one of the 12 people that owned a Genesis.
Yes! And I didn't have many good games because we couldn't afford them. So my mom would pick through the $5 bin at Walmart and get the games that nobody wanted. And those are the games that I got. And some of them didn't work. And yeah, that's.
Well, hey, you had something to play. That's better than no console.
This is true.
I did. And I had Aladdin, and that was pretty cool.
Oh, man, that game.
Sonic.
Yeah, Aladdin was pretty good.
That game was so difficult, like getting out of the Cave of Wonders.
Yeah. And the only reason I ever beat it is because I knew the cheat code. Like, I got to the last level and I could not get past that, you know, the final boss. And I had the cheat code, so I knew how it ended. But yeah, it was hard. This is cool.
Yeah. And like, he's really going overboard with the art. It looks like these screenshots are just amazing. Like that flame wolf sword attack that she's doing in that screenshot. Wow. Wow.
So when you say spiritual successor, does that mean...
So it's
kind of
Castlevania. Like Castlevania is normally about Dracula and his castle randomly appearing, usually in Japan or somewhere else. Oh no, in the 3DS ones it was Japan, but every other time it was Transylvania or wherever. And his castle would like shift around every game. It would be slightly different, but usually a lot of the things would be the same. You'd have a vampire hunter of the Belmont clan wielding a magical, holy, blessed whip that can destroy evil, kind of the game's version of the Master Sword. And only in later games did they start adding like different weapons you could equip and stuff. And you go through the castle, you defeat a boss, you get an upgrade that gives you a new ability, which is kind of reminiscent of Metroid games, all the side-scrolling 2D Metroid games.
Oh, another series I haven't played.
So both games sort of led to this kind of game genre colloquially referred to as Metroidvania. Basically, any game where you go through side-scrolling levels in a large map, kill bosses, get upgrades.
I'm familiar with the term. See, like, I feel like, I know, I guess my childhood was somewhat deprived because I never owned an NES console. I never owned any Nintendo anything as a kid. I was a PC gamer. I had Atari. Actually, believe it or not, Atari did make a PC computer for a number of years. So I had those, and I remember getting into flame wars with people in elementary school about how the PC was superior to anything Nintendo put out because you could upgrade the GPU and you could do all these upgrades, upgrade the processor. I was a real nerd. I would take computers apart, put them back together. So I kind of, even though I was like fully aware of the console generation, and I was somewhat part of it because I would play it at people's houses, and sometimes on the weekends my parents would let me rent an NES or Super NES from Blockbuster, and I would have a game for the weekend, but I would never get through anything. So like classic games, you would think I would have played like Super Mario Brothers or Zelda. I played for like all of like 2 days and I never finished any of them. So to this day, I haven't really finished any of those classic games. I mean, I guess I can go back through them now, which I am kind of doing that because I'm going again through like a nostalgic phase because I bought an NES recently and a bunch of games for it. I have a copy of Super Mario 2, but I've been told Super Mario Brothers 3 is supposedly the best game. I don't really know. That just shows you how much I don't know about Nintendo games. I have a Sega Genesis and a Sega CD as well, that I recently, well, within the last couple of years, purchased, and I have some games on that. Sonic CD is awesome. I don't know. I'm oddly fascinated with the Genesis and the Sega CD because they were, I just think the company and that whole period of time is fascinating because it was such a flop, and it's just such an interesting story about the whole development process and how it came to be, and just it's really interesting. I don't know why I'm fascinated with that console, even though I know there were tons of superior games on Super NES, but I don't know. I just like that console. It's the underdog. And I remember when that console came out, a friend of mine had the 16-bit Model 2 Genesis, and I remember I just remember loving that console. In particular, I have fond memories of playing RoboCop on that. So I don't know. I just keep going back to that. But anyways, I know. Sorry, I derailed the conversation from this Castlevania remake. But we're starting to talk about old games, so I was like,
"Oh, I always wanted a Nintendo." I remember being, you know, really little and crying because I wanted one so much, and just, you know, we were poor, so I never had a Nintendo, and I don't remember why I got the Genesis over the SNES. I'm trying to remember, and I think it was actually because I had friends who had an SNES. So it was like, oh, I'd be the cool one who had the Genesis that nobody else had.
I vaguely recall the Genesis getting marked down heavily because it was not selling well. So I do remember in that period of time in the early 90s, so late 80s, early 90s, there was the first generation, second generation Genesis. But anyways, I remember they started to heavily mark down the consoles, and I remember some friends of mine who didn't have one started, their parents were buying them because they were dropping in price. So I'm sure that probably helped Sega somewhat. But I mean, even if you look at the 32X as well, which is just a monstrosity. I don't know if you guys have ever seen a picture of what all of these consoles look like bolted together, but it's hilarious. I don't actually own a 32X, but effectively the way they were designed, if you look it up, so you would have the Sega Genesis, then the Sega CD would plug into the the Genesis sits on top of the Sega CD via external cable attachment thing, and then the 32X plugged into the cartridge of the Genesis. So by the time you stack these three things together, it's huge, and you have three separate power adapters, okay? Separate video cables, separate audio cables going to the Genesis, and then another audio cable going to the Sega CD.
Brutal.
It was so bad, and it looked terrible in the living room, and you would need to have, like, you know, you'd need to buy an extra power bar because you'd run out of plugs. So it, so many reasons why that thing failed, but
it's like the N64 expansion pack's extremely elderly relative, or like the Voltron of game consoles, perhaps. Buy my powers combined, or no, that's Captain Planet.
Well, I'm looking at it, and I don't know why I'm thinking of Cylons, but I'm thinking of Cylons.
It is a little angular, yeah.
And that, especially like the 32X attachment going into like the Genesis's game slot. I don't know. It's kind of got that visory.
Yeah,
Cylon
there
to
could
it.
There could be a strobe LED in there.
Yeah,
you could mod
yeah.
one, spray paint it silver.
It just looks so foreboding. Like,
it does.
Just in
it's
low
scary.
Lighting in your home theater, staring at you.
An unblinking eye of doom.
Maybe that's secretly the reason why Sega failed. So many children just had night terrors.
Because they made scary looking consoles.
They never slept.
Well, it did run Doom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was that on the Sega CD or the 32X?
The 32X.
Right. Okay. It's probably like the one and only game that was worthwhile.
Yeah, probably.
It had a very tiny library,
but,
even
hey,
smaller than the CD.
If you want to get a really obscure and terrible console, you should get the Philips CDI and try those horrifying Zelda games.
Yeah, no, that's
These
not
are the faces of evil.
What was the Sega console that came out right after the Genesis, like the 32X, they came out with something right after that, and I don't recall what it was.
The Saturn.
Was it the Saturn? Okay. I remember somebody that had that. But you know what? I honestly can't remember any games that were out for that. So I don't know what that says about the console.
Not a lot. It was also a flop.
Yeah, I don't even remember it.
So we have, so this spiritual successor to Castlevania, and
I backed
you
it.
You backed it. Okay.
I backed it. I've given in.
Maybe I'll go and do that. What's the current goal?
It's It's past the goal.
Past the goal. Okay.
Yeah, the goal was 500,000, and they have over 1 million right now, with 31 days to go.
So you guys mentioned Konami, and obviously this is, a lot of people have been talking about this in the news and on podcasts, but there was an interesting video that I came across. I think it's called Konami versus Kojima, and it's pretty interesting because there's a lot that the public doesn't know, but apparently Konami had this video taken down due to copyright infringement or some BS reason why, but there's, now that they have done that, people are starting to talk that maybe this video had released certain information that must have been true about the company, because why take a video down that somebody made on YouTube about this whole thing? But there have been, it's not just Kojima, right, that is now out. I've heard that they are having a bunch of internal restructuring, and that they have entire departments and teams have been removed. And I know Kojima's production company in the U.S. has now just been renamed to Konami or something Productions.
Yeah, it's not looking good. I think he's definitely out. They've just done the usual Japanese thing, or maybe other places do this, but in Japan, this happens quite a lot. Basically, when they decide that your position is redundant, but they can't quite get rid of you yet, they just kind of put you in a room for you to do nothing while you wait to get your severance.
Well, I mean, he is still working on the Phantom Pain, right?
Well, ostensibly, we don't know if he's actually still working on it or not for sure. Like, the game is mostly done at this point.
There was a video that came out recently. I mean, mind you, I don't know when the actual video was recorded, but it came out, I think, last week. And Kojima's answering questions about the Phantom Pain, and he said that the game is in the stages of just polishing the last bit of details that are in the game with respect to stealth combat balance and some of the multiplayer aspects. So they've also said that Kojima's status is contractor now. On the one hand, I don't like it, and it seems like they're doing everything wrong, but I just, it's hard for me to make a comment about it because I don't know what's really going on inside, and I'm kind of hesitant to make any guesses about that. I mean, they have to make whatever decisions they feel are right for their business.
Well, I'm not so sure that that's what it is. Like, I think really the theory about it being that they don't want Konami to be synonymous with Kojima, I think that has some weight, because it's like, well, without Kojima, what is Konami really?
Well, they haven't really put out that much.
No.
Over the last few years.
The last few years, it's all been Metal Gear Solid, and...
Right. And who knows if it will even continue as a property, right?
Well, it depends who owns the rights. Like, if Kojima owns a lot of the stuff, then they might still be able to make a Metal Gear Solid game,
right,
but they might not be able to use a bunch of the stuff. It depends where those chips fall.
So the interesting thing that I heard him say in this interview was that, as far as he's concerned, regardless of if the IP itself continues in some fashion down the road, as far as he's concerned, the series comes to a conclusion with the Phantom Pain.
The fourth one was kind of a definitive ending in the future. This one's a prequel, technically, so I assume it just kind of rounds out the story and reveals anything that was left to be revealed.
Yeah. Since we're on the topic of Hideo Kojima. Did you see that tweet that's been flying around today? A lot of people are...
Oh, the gross action figure?
Yep, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, it's like that character's costume is problematic enough, but to make an action figure with squeezable boobs, you've... Ugh.
I can't,
too far.
I can't quite bring myself to actually look at the video for this because it's just... it's wrong. Like, it's so wrong.
There's, I mean, it, again, just from what I've seen of his personality, stuff that he sticks in games, the little Easter eggs and whatnot, I'm not entirely surprised that he posted something like that. I saw a little clip of something in that the Phantom Pain where, what was it? It was like, okay, so you know how Snake, you know, through, you know, the series, you know, is the classic, Snake can hide in a box, right? Move around and be all stealthy.
Is this the pinup distraction
thing?
Yeah. So he like deploys a thing and it unfolds to reveal a pinup model and the guards just like slobber over it. They like literally walk over and go, and then Snake kills them.
That's insulting on, I don't know, like, let's just stop and think about what you're saying about men and how one gullible and I don't even know.
Well, it's also reducing them to just complete idiots. Like you're saying that these highly trained soldiers
can be distracted by cardboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, there are very, you know, number one is obviously the whole like objectification of women and all of that, which is so obvious that I'm not, like, I wasn't even going to mention it, but I don't want people to be like, well, why are you worried about that when, you know, there's a pinup cardboard cutout? I don't know why we're still having these conversations today. I just don't understand.
Well, that's what happens when you have somebody of that has that kind of power. It's you know, he's the creative vision. So it's, you know, he has pull in what goes into the game, and if that's what he wants, that's what he's gonna get. I mean, he has every right to put that in the game, but of course it may run the risk of alienating some people. But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not gonna hurt sales. I mean, if a couple thousand people boycott it, it doesn't matter. They're still gonna sell hundreds of thousands of copies of the game. That being said, does it make it right? No, of course not, because it's not really helping the industry that as a whole already has a problem with, you know, people in marginalized spaces being women or people of color or whatever. It's really not helping things. It's bad. I mean, it could be worse for sure.
I don't think games with elements like that shouldn't exist. The problem I have is that games like with elements like that are still the mainstream games. They're all of the games, you know?
Yeah, I'm as a guy, I'm less upset that there's a pinup girl on the box as a distraction. I'm more upset that like the men are portrayed as complete idiots, that, you know, the like zero intelligence.
Yeah, it's basically saying like the male gaze is this like unavoidable, all-encompassing thing that even the most hardened soldier cannot resist. Like, okay.
This is, so here's the thing. So I want to talk a little bit about Japanese culture in general, because the way I see it, from what I understand of Japanese culture, as being someone who loves anime and knows, has read enough about it over the years, is that my take on this is that this is played up as entirely as a joke. These types of things are considered a joke, whereas in Western society, we look at that as being completely offensive. And yes, we can analyze it and pinpoint the reasons that are wrong, but it just does not occur to many people. It does not occur to men. I should say it doesn't occur to a lot of Japanese men. And that's not to say that they're all like that. Of course, that's obviously not the case, but the people that are working on these games and working in media, you see it in animation all the time. I have like, I get creeped out with this over this fascination that people have about sexualizing underage teenage idols, you know, that whole idol craze. It's really creepy. There's stuff that I've seen in anime and manga that to me crosses the line so often into pedophile territory. But in Japan, the interesting thing I've actually found out about this recently is that they don't have the same kind of laws that we do here. And all of that stuff is just, it's just the norm. It's so pervasive that it's nobody, everybody overlooks it.
Yeah, there's loopholes too in those laws. Like basically it's like if it's in an anime or a manga, it's okay. That's literally the bar in Japan. Like they can show whatever the hell as long as A, it's an animation or an illustration, and B, they draw black bars on certain things. And that's it. Those are the only limitations.
Yeah, and see, bizarre. That's another thing, like, too, the censorship thing is weird because they allow all this stuff to happen, but then, like, in Japanese porn, they you can't have a guy's penis exposed without it, having it, you know, pixelated. It's just, like, silly stuff like this. Like, what's more problematic is the borderline, like, you know, pedophilia stuff that is so prevalent in everything. But I think, you know, a lot of the stuff like the teen idol stuff, a lot of people see it more as cute rather than pervy, but to Western culture it's looked upon as like really pervy. There's I don't recall the name of it, but I remember years ago, funny enough, my ex-girlfriend got into this anime series about this young teenage girl. I don't think she's like more than 14 or 15 or something in the series. And she's just like highly sexed and is constantly, she's like infatuated with her teacher, who happens to be male. And she's always like just trying to grope him. And I just like thought this is the creepiest thing ever. Like, I cannot believe that this is something that just is totally okay with people.
And that's like a whole so meme strange now. That's like the whole notice me senpai meme,
right? It's so strange.
It's a bit of a cultural disconnect, and it's, I think, one of the big issues, like, in an anime, I mean, okay, it's still bad, but in an anime, we at least see, okay, yeah, it's a cartoon, it's not supposed to be real life. But I think the problem in something like Metal Gear Solid is they treat the subject matter that much more realistically, so when they try to do a joke like this, it comes off as disingenuous and wrong somehow. Like, if Metal Gear Solid were some kind of cartoonish anime game, then it might make sense to do something like that. You'd be like, oh yeah, ha ha ha. But because it's this realistic world where there are these realistic people, it suddenly makes no sense and it feels really weird and inappropriate.
Well, and they're not even like jokey games, you know? I've played Metal Gear Solid 4, and I thought it was a great game, but it's not, you know, it's not like, I don't know, World of Warcraft. There are a lot of little jokes and fun quests and you know, little offhand things that are said, and that's not Metal Gear Solid. It's like a serious game. I mean, there's an occasional one-liner or whatever, but, like, so, yeah, even more than just the art style, it doesn't fit in with anything else to, you know, when you're looking at it through a Western gaze.
It's, yeah, it comes across as completely gratuitous. It'd be like, imagine if, okay, so like imagine if you're watching an episode of 24 and, you know, super serious, you know, drama, you know, action TV show, and Jack Bauer's in the middle of a like super intense hostage negotiation or something, and then suddenly out of nowhere, he slips on a banana peel.
Right. Yeah.
Right? It's just like, yeah. That is the kind of thing that you see in a Metal Gear Solid game. Like, it's just, it comes out of complete nowhere. And it's like, what? And I don't get the joke. Like, guys, it's not funny at all.
Yeah. It's like they just kind of insert these things without context because they want to or because they think it's cute. I don't know. But it just doesn't work.
Well, and games are regionalized all the time, right? Like, some jokes are taken out and others are put in. And it just, it makes me wonder, like, what are they doing for the American audience? How much do they care? How much of a joke is it really in Japan? You know, these are things that I have no idea.
It is difficult. I don't know who's responsible for that kind of stuff at Konami. Well, I imagine Konami must handle all of it, but it would be better if there was like a Western company that was in charge of kind of screening this stuff and would say like this.
That's usually what happens. There's usually a subsidiary that handles localization for that region. So if there's Konami America, they'll probably handle it, just like for Nintendo of America.
This is why I think for me, I find it very problematic to play it. Like, there's so many JRPG games that just something is lost in the translation. So, like, I just find so many Japanese games just terrible. Like, I can't get through them. There's something about, like, the way they make games in general, like, just in a broad sense, that I just can't connect with. Just from, like, the characters. Like, I love anime, but I don't know. Japanese games, there's so few that I find tolerable. Like, Danganronpa 1 and 2, for example. I love those games, but there's so many other of those types of games, like visual novels, that are just, they're not, for one thing, they're not translated well. That's like one major aspect. And so when something's not translated well, and I'm not talking about just grammatical issues, because, you know, those are easier to overlook sometimes, but just other things, like when things are just translated verbatim, they sometimes don't work. And this is not just translating Japanese to English. It goes for any language. There are nuances that are lost, and you really need, you know, somebody or, you know, more than one person to look at this and really understand, someone who really understands the language and is really able to not just translate it into that language it needs to be translated into, but really make sure that it makes sense, and that if it's being translated into English, that somebody, the consumer who will end up playing that game, will actually be able to understand it and connect with it. And that's why a lot of Japanese themes don't work for me personally. I know a lot of people that are really into JRPGs. It just doesn't work for me, for the most part. So.
Well, and that translation thing applies, like you were saying, across the board, like to books. Oh, you didn't like Tolstoy translated by this person, try this translation instead. You might like it better. So it's kind of a universal thing, you know.
And actually, this on the topic of translations, it is problematic in anime too. And for the most part, you know, this is one thing where it's gotten better over the years. And One person that's being very vocal about this is voice actor Crispin Freeman, who's done a lot of voiceover work in the anime world, and this is one topic that he's often talks about in his voiceover classes and his own podcast, is that especially in the early 90s and on some of the projects that he even worked on, is that oftentimes the translations were done so poorly. So oftentimes people would just blame the voice actors for doing a bad job. But when it was really, if you examine it carefully, it's really the dialogue just doesn't make sense. Like sometimes they'll ask the voice actor to say this line, and then oftentimes he would actually question it and be like, well, this just kind of sounds weird in English, so how about we try this? And so, but you need somebody like that on any kind of translation, whether it's an anime or a video game. You need somebody to reinterpret stuff, even though it's really not necessarily word for word perfect translation. As long as you get sort of the spirit of what that, I think, the original content creator was intending, but change it in a way so that it does make sense for the audience, I think that's really, really more important.
Well, and voiceover acting for, like, you know, anime is extraordinarily hard, because you actually have to, you know, it's already done. So you're trying to match what you're saying to what's translated to what's appearing on screen, so that you're not, you know, talking when the character's lips aren't moving, and it's extraordinarily complex and difficult.
And a lot of the time they try to map it exactly to, like, the lip movements and everything, so it makes the translation that much more difficult. Though, for anime, so they usually fudge it, like, it's always like, like, they never actually say anything, their mouths just go for roughly the length of time that the sentence goes on. And then they'll cut away so that you can't see the person's mouth. They'll do that a lot too.
It makes me think of He-Man. Just like a shot of his head with lips moving and no expression.
Because they could only afford to animate the lips.
Those, I don't know, like 25 cells.
So we should talk about something that's, I think, maybe a little more positive than sexism in the gaming industry. Though I'm sure we'll have to circle back to that topic. There's a new Assassin's Creed game.
Yay!
Coming out that has a female and male protagonist.
And
this
it's
time.
Set in steampunk Victorian London.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Some of the character designs look pretty nice.
So I've never played Assassin's Creed, but this looks pretty cool.
I haven't played those games in quite a long time. I think the last one, actually, I didn't even complete it. What was the one with the last female protagonist? Liberation, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. 2012.
Yeah, she was like a French girl. I don't remember her name.
Aveline.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. But there were so many bugs with the AI. I just got pissed off at that game.
Yeah, they fixed it up a bit for the
some
PS3
of it in the
re-release.
HD, right, yeah. I tried that, and yeah, it was a bit better, but I don't know. I just kind of gave up. I got tired of the whole Assassin's Creed genre just because they kept churning out the same stuff over and over and over again.
They've kind of had an even odd record. So the first one was kind of eh. Second one was really good. The third one was actually still pretty good. The fourth one, bleh, just more of the same, and it got boring. Assassin's Creed 3 was just awful. Then they released Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag, which was awesome, because pirates.
So you're firmly on the pirates side of the pirates versus ninjas debate?
Oh no, I still would like to see an Assassin's Creed game set in China or something. That would be pretty epic. But
I totally skipped Black Flag. Is that, do you think it's worth a shot?
Oh, definitely. They upgraded a lot of the stuff, and of course, piloting the pirate ship and fighting other ships, it's pretty great. The system they developed for that was pretty easy, but then challenging to master, so it ended up being pretty fun. Plus the sea shanties that you could collect, that the crew sings while you're sailing, also good.
So you think Ubisoft is learning?
No.
After the flack they got
last
year?
No, they're just reacting to everyone being mad at them.
Sure.
Because they could have easily put female characters into Unity, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm. Michael, that costs extra development time. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. It's so difficult to animate female characters. So
well, the stupid thing is they had Assassin's Creed Liberation with a female protagonist, and then they just kind of... It was like the one-off thing.
Oh, but that was the Vita game that nobody will buy. Like, yeah. So it's encouraging to hear that this one will actually have two protagonists. However, the potential... What's the opposite of a silver lining? Anyway, the potential con to this is that the same story mentions that the male protagonist may have roughly 70 to 80% of the story missions.
Shocking.
But when you're doing free play, you can switch between them freely. So, yeah.
It's something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of sad that I'm at a point where I'm like, well... You get points for trying, kind of.
So I have a question for you, Aline. So how much do you care about playing female protagonist in a game? If you have the choice between male or female, do you normally just pick your own gender? Or like, how do you feel about that?
If I have a choice, I usually pick a female. If I don't have a choice, you know, like, I don't know. I gush about it a lot. The Last of Us is one of my favorite games.
That is an amazing game.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I can't remember her name. The woman that Joel is with in Boston before they leave.
The name escapes me now, too.
That was right at the start of the game.
Yeah, and she's like this amazing, strong...
Was she the head of the fire?
No,
that was the other woman.
That was Maureen, but no, I can't remember her name. Dang it! I think it's
Tess.
With a T. Yes, Tess. Thank you. So you've got Tess, and so like we're walking through the streets, and I'm like, oh, she's really really cool. When do I get to play as her? And you never do. And you know, I liked the parts. You know, spoiler alert: if you haven't played yet, you play as Ellie later on through some parts, and I was like, yes. Look at this girl go. This is amazing. And yeah, I want to see more women doing cool things.
Absolutely. Ellie's such a great character.
Oh,
and
I love the have you played the DLC?
Yes. The DLC is amazing. That story between her and what's her name? Her best friend. It's so sweet and sad at the same time. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Why don't we have more of this?
And I haven't heard from anybody. You know, I'm sure there are people out there who didn't like it, but...
Well, I feel like it's overlooked, you know, and that's what frustrates me is that you've got, like, a big game, big successful game like The Last of Us, and this DLC, which was amazing, and it got very little coverage, and no one's talking about it. Nobody's celebrating this amazing game. I mean, it's not very long, but it's got such a wonderful story, and the character development is amazing, and the relationships between these two people is amazing. And it just felt like I can really see two teenagers talking like this. It just felt, the dialogue felt human. They felt like real human beings.
Yeah.
And that's not very common in movies or games.
Yeah. Well, and the way they weaved the story together, it was excellent storytelling that the flashbacks to the past. I liked it so much I tried to enter in my Facebook password so that I could post little photo booth pictures to Facebook. And I don't post to Facebook, let alone let it try to integrate with anything. You know, it was...
That was actually a really well done feature.
Yeah. Well, my password is too long, so I couldn't actually do it. But, like, I tried. So, yeah, I mean, I think the thing about... the movement that shall not be named, as you know, there's a lot of like women are trying to change video games and they're trying to take, you know, Metal Gear Solid and Grand Theft Auto away from me. And that's not at all true. It's just, we want to see ourselves in games sometimes too. And I think it's very clear that there's a market for it. And there are people, not just women, who want different perspectives and different types of stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this is where I'm looking to the indies, because I don't think that AAA is going to be able to move fast enough to do that.
You know what also I'm getting tired of is the same old type of tropes regurgitated over and over, like, oh, family man with wife and daughter has you know, family taken away brutally, and then he goes on a rampage, and
I never want to see
this
that
has
again.
Been done so many times in movies and video games. I think actually Nicolas Cage has a new movie coming out, and he's got the same exact bullshit story. But yeah, like, what about a gay man as a protagonist in a story? And why not have that as a thing in a game? Like, you know, gay men have families too. I mean,
no way. <Yeah. laughs> No way.
Big shock.
Guys can raise kids. This is amazing. Yeah. Well, it's a formula, right? I've read this recently where it's like big game studios, they want what's been proven to work. So it's kind of like a Mad Libs type thing where you have your formula and you just plug things in and that's what you spit out.
Right. Well, certainly the big publishers, they're certainly risk averse.
Mm-hmm. For good reason. But, I don't blame them.
I understand. I mean, they have to, they want to protect their business, but
they're leaving money on the table.
The way I see it is, I really think it's not as risky as they might think it is, especially in 2015. Somebody has to put their foot forward and lead the way and say, we are going to make a change. This is going to be the direction. Somebody has to step forward and be brave enough to do this. Otherwise, just nobody's going to do anything.
Well, this conversation, I think, ties so well into the other thing that we were going to talk about, which is Black Widow, the Avengers toy coming out, and it's this cool scene in the Avengers movie where Black Widow is riding a motorcycle and she saves the day, right? She gets Captain America's shield. She's amazing. She's fabulous. And
though they did kind of like weaken it a little with that, I'm always picking up after you boys comment that she had to say, but yeah, she was still badass.
Yeah, she was. And, you know, I will forgive them that line. Like, I'm at a point where I rolled my eyes. I wanted to punch Jeremy Renner every time I saw a stupid face on the screen.
Oh, God. He still hasn't apologized properly. He's just like completely like, whatever.
He doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. So now we have this toy where Black Widow has this really amazing scene, and Black Widow isn't actually in the toy. It's Captain America.
No, now we get Captain America on the motorcycle.
And so,
which never happened.
Never happened. So this erasure is happening, you know, over and over and over again, and it's through all genres. And I don't understand. It just boggles my mind.
Well, that goes again back to the toy industry, another industry that likes gender roles, you know, and little girls would never buy a superhero action figure, right? So why bother including her?
Oh, right. This is what I was going to say, and it ties into this. It's stupid because there's like a mountain of evidence that catering to women, catering to different roles, makes a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what was it a while ago? There was something, and because it had a woman in it, they made like, oh, right, the female Thor. They've sold like 40% more comics as a result.
Yep.
Just from doing that. Just by looking at a different opinion, a different worldview, just by embracing something different. Well,
I think
40% more sales.
I think more than just that, I think it's also something fresh. It's like 99% of comics are just the buff white dude. So it's kind of refreshing to see somebody else in a position of power.
Yeah.
Well, last time I was on the show, we talked about comic books and how there's a dearth of comic books for little kids and little girls especially. And this comes back to the toys too. Like, The whole thing about marketing to kids is you snag them early and you get brand loyalty for life. You know, this is why advertisers go after kids. And so by not advertising and not marketing toward and not catering to girls and just leaving them out of the equation, and I'm using girls really broadly here, right? Like, you know, the stereotypical girly girl, you know, there's room for a Black Widow with her. You know, and I think they're leaving money on the table. And
well, girls need strong role models, and they need role models that are more than just some pretty princess, right? That we've seen the same thing over and over and over again. I guarantee you, if there was an aisle of like Black Widow dolls, I guarantee you girls would be buying that, because there would be little girls dressing up as Black Widow
for
Halloween. Total missed opportunity.
Yeah, it is. From, you know, there's obviously the reasons I want it to happen, which is the, you know, stronger kids, more diverse people to look up to, get them, you know, like all of these altruistic things that, like, I think are really important. But for the businesses, I just think it's absolutely short-sighted of them. Like, you exist to make money. That is your sole reason for existing. And you're refusing to serve a huge demographic. And that it just doesn't make any sense. And then there's the things I want. I want to see more amazing women doing amazing things. I want to see more people of color doing amazing things. And, you know, that's, you know.
Well, it's when I, the last time I went into a toy store, they had, like, I was looking at buying some Nerf guns, and they have this really awesome, like, Nerf bow and arrow. But then they have a version for girls, which is the pretty much exact same thing, except it's pink. It's like, it's a bow and arrow, guys. You don't have to apply that pink color and sell it to girls only. That doesn't make any sense. It's a genderless product. It doesn't. It just drives me nuts.
And as someone who was a little girl who did not want to have anything to do with the color pink, and who was all about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and like, they made a mint off of girls in my hometown who loved the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and we weren't playing April O'Neil. We were the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles kicking butt, and it's depressing.
Yeah, actually, April O'Neil is one of those characters, just as a bit of an aside, but she's changed a bit in the comics over the years, and I don't, this might be a controversial opinion, but I liked the remake live action movie, and I thought Megan Fox was actually really good as April O'Neil, and I actually liked her character. I thought she was a very strong character. She was a very strong journalist and had strong opinions and stuck to her guns and, you know, was dedicated to finding the truth about what was going on in the plot. And I thought she was really good. And I recently rewatched the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And as much as I'd like to continue to love that movie. It's really an inferior movie in so many ways, but especially in if you just compare April O'Neil's character in that iteration, she's just this girl that kind of follows them around, and it's just, she doesn't do anything.
She waits and for Casey to save her.
Oh my God, I could not, I really didn't like that relationship. I hated that they end up getting romantically involved because he's an asshole in that movie. And he's totally like this kind of like, you know, womanizing dude. And it just feels like the way he talks, he's like trying to wear her down, and then she just kind of goes along with it, and it just felt so unnatural to me. So I like that they didn't do that in this movie.
I haven't seen it, so I can't. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't know if you guys heard the news today, but they released some photos from the set of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles sequel, and of course, obviously, Megan Fox is back in as April O'Neil, but the original actress that played April O'Neil in the 1990 movie has a major role in this film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's playing, I can't remember the character she's playing, but I think she's a journalist as well. But anyway, she's got a major role in this movie. I thought that was kind of a nice nod.
Hopefully it's not the usual play where she ends up being April O'Neil's mom.
Yeah.
Because didn't they do that in Superman Returns? They had like the old Lois Lane. Or no, that was Smallville. That was Smallville. They had the old Lois Lane be the current Lois Lane's mom.
I don't know. That doesn't really bother me as much. I don't know. I kind of think that's just like a nice nod to the fans who are old enough to remember the original series or have watched the older movies. Like, I know with the new Flash TV series, the guy that played Barry Allen plays Barry Allen's father in the TV series. And he was the original Flash. And I know there are probably plenty of people that haven't seen that very short-lived early 90s TV series. But I just thought it was so cool that they brought the actor back because he was involved with the franchise. So, I don't know. I like
it. Yeah, it's... I don't know. It's half good, half dumb. I don't know.
Did you know that the new Mad Max remake, the guy that played Toe Cutter in the original is playing a different character in the Tom Hardy remake? I recently watched Mad Max for the first time, believe it or not.
Yeah, I haven't seen
Bought
it.
Bought it on Blu-ray.
I've never seen it either.
Toe Cutter is the main baddie in the movie, and that actor, they brought him back.
Is that the guy that goes on the megaphone?
He's, let me find a picture of him. He's got like white hair and a creepy looking mask. He's like the main, I think he's like the main baddie in this remake as well, but he's like a different character. He was such a creepy, just like amazing actor, like so dedicated to that role. Just, I was watching the commentary, Mel Gibson was saying he was just like off and on set. He was that character, totally became that character. And, it's just really cool to see him back in this, in this new movie. It remains to be seen how good this remake is, but I'm pumped.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Supposedly the new film is really good, though. It's got 97% on Rotten Tomatoes right now.
From who, though? Pre-screening or what?
Yeah, like from critic reviews.
Interesting. Is there a release date for that?
It's this week, the 15th, so Friday.
Oh, nice. I had no idea it was that close to being
released.
Yeah,
there's already 35 reviews. Only one of them is bad. Probably from one guy that doesn't enjoy fun. Yep, David Edwards from the Daily Mirror in England.
I have no idea who that is.
Noisy, explosive, and visually spectacular, but depressingly hollow. That's not why we're going to see that film. But thanks.
Well, I mean, the first Mad Max has a very simplistic plot. That's
well,
not
yeah,
the point.
Exactly. It's not the point. It is
a bleak. It's supposed to be a bleak post-apocalyptic movie. I mean, even in that movie too, Mad Max has, again, it's very tropey, but I mean, considering when it came out, that's not surprising. But I mean, because in the original, Mad Max is a cop effectively, and you know, he's getting revenge for the gang, one of the biker gangs that you know. I don't, should I say anything that'll spoil the first movie if you haven't seen it? Anyways, it is. It's a revenge story. Okay, so people die that are close to him, and it's basically that's it. That's all there is to the plot. Around that though is an amazing movie with, you know, completely practical special effects. There, you know, when that movie came out, there was no CGI. All the car stunts are real. I mean, the motorcycle stunts too are just unbelievable in that movie. I mean, there's stuff in there that is just like, I cannot believe that they managed to do the stunts that they did without anybody dying. Wow. Interestingly, if you actually watch the commentary, and actually on the new Shout Factory re-release of that movie, which just recently came out on Blu-ray, there's a brand new interview with Mel Gibson. He was saying some of the stunts, first of all the people that were doing the stunts, like, apparently were totally insane. Back then, they had a very tiny budget, and they didn't have like the same kind of like insurance that they had in new movies today, and people were doing like things that were like totally reckless, and there were tons of people that got really hurt on set, but nobody actually died. So it was kind of like a miracle that nobody got more seriously injured. Oh, wow. In that film. Yeah, there's some stuff in that movie that's just unbelievable. You have to see it, both of you. See the original before you see the remake.
Okay.
Alrighty then.
So what else is going on that's just going to make us sad?
Ooh. X-Files will return in January.
Yeah.
It's not sad,
that's,
but it's
that's not surprising. Well, I mean, they said they were going to film in August, right? So, I mean, it takes time. They're filming 6 episodes. Then there's post-production.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a reasonable timeline.
Yeah.
There's going to be a Minority Report television show.
What?
Yeah, I heard about that a while back.
It takes place after the movie, after pre-crime has been destroyed, and the main character is one of the precogs, specifically one of the twins, Dashiell. So it like perfectly ties to the movie without being completely tied to the movie. So it's like a long time later, and he can still see crimes, like flashes of crimes. So he like partners with a detective to try and stop crimes before they happen. And then apparently there's going to be like some mythology stuff revolving around the movie. And
is this a Netflix series?
It's on Fox, actually.
See, I'm worried. I'm concerned. Because the movie was so good, and it wrapped things up so nicely at the end. I'll give it a shot. I just cannot fathom what direction they're going to take.
I think Spielberg is producing it, so it may be okay. I'm not sure. But
yeah, well, Spielberg was also involved in the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. You know how that turned
out. But he had no say in that matter. Yeah. I don't seem to recall that. But
the Indiana Jones movie, I'll pretend it didn't exist.
I heard rumors, but it never happened. It was weird.
Yeah, just like that other one with the saucer men that never happened, right? Actually, no, that was the original working title.
And they're doing another Indiana Jones movie.
They're thinking about it.
No?
Kathleen Kennedy sort of said, maybe, I guess, which is...
Because they've been bouncing around the idea that they were going to get... Okay, so they were either going to go in two directions. They were going to get Harrison Ford again, or they're going to reboot and cast a younger actor in the
role. Chris Pratt. Chris Pratt. No,
don't even get me started on Jurassic Park. Don't.
As much as I love Harrison Ford, I'm sorry, the guy is almost 70. How you cannot realistically have a guy swing on a whip at that age? It doesn't work.
Although they'd have him in the Sean Connery role as the bumbling sidekick or something. Yeah, no. Even if they make another Indiana Jones movie, they have not made another Indiana Jones movie, you know? I just don't think I can do it again.
Is there a fan edit that deletes that stupid CGI monkey scene?
If there were a fan edit, I would have to delete a lot more.
That's just what I was thinking.
That's like the least of the problems.
The second he climbs in that refrigerator and it's blasted and it opens up and he comes out as not soup, I was like, this movie is going to be horrible.
Aline, that fridge was made of lead, okay? It had lead casing.
I will.
Come on,
don't try to justify it.
He should have been soup from the impact. Like, there's just
And even if the impact didn't kill him, the fallout would have killed him from radiation poisoning.
If that entire movie was a like fever dream?
Like mine that I shared with everybody, or
no, like Indy really didn't come out of that alive. Like he
was dying in a hospital from
radiation. He's like dying in a hospital from radiation poisoning.
Yeah, we could do that. In fact,
that would make more sense.
He
has to pass the torch. He's got to pass the torch to his son on his deathbed.
Yeah,
take this whip and hat.
And instead of Shia LaBeouf as a crummy greaser, it can be somebody else as his son.
By the way, do either of you remember in the Crystal Skull movie that when they go over the boat goes over the, was it the boat that goes
over
the waterfall?
They went over like three waterfalls.
Okay, so they go over the waterfall and his hat is still on.
Oh God, there's too many
things. How does his hat not fall off? It makes no sense.
There are too many things that make no sense in that movie.
Yeah,
too many.
Okay, let's not turn this into a podcast where we're just talking about that.
It's impossible not to fall into that.
I thought maybe like he like had some Velcro or some kind of attachment to keep the hat on, but
well, they make
no.
You know, like the tape they make, the adhesive they make for like women's dresses to make sure that Janet Jackson incidents don't happen. Maybe he just preemptively apply some of that before he goes on an adventure so that it'll stay on his head.
And I thought there was a cowboy thing to keep your hat on as well. Like something they used in the Old West to keep their hats from flying off when they were riding on their horses really fast. I feel like there was a thing, like a hat clip something.
But even cowboy hats, don't they have that? I don't know what it's called.
Like
but
the cord that goes
the string,
under your
the
chin?
String that is attached to the top of the hat and goes under your neck so that your hat doesn't fly off when you're riding a horse.
Yeah, but you never see...
Not typically.
Yeah, no? You don't usually see those.
I grew up in farm country, ask me anything.
but I saw it in like cowboy movies in the 50s. That's what they had.
Maybe in the 50s, I don't know. Modern cowboy hats don't really do that though.
Yeah.
You need more of a safari cap.
Yeah, those all have the chin strap thing. I don't know.
We don't need more reboots, do we? Of old properties?
Probably not, no.
Like, just leave it alone. Please let it die.
It's okay. They're too busy making stupid disaster movies that make no sense. San Andreas.
Sharknado.
Well, at least you know what you're getting with that.
Oh, Sharknado.
Like, this San Andreas film, like, I saw the trailer, they're like, even though it's happening here, you'll feel it on the East Coast. And I'm like, what? Is this a 15 on the Richter scale? Like, what?
But it has The Rock, and I have such a crush on him. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it... I don't know. And then they show like this massive tsunami, just like 2012 level tsunami. And it's just like, what on the Richter scale is this? Like the buildings are just crumpling like Play-Doh being squished. And it's like, how? The San Andreas Fault does not have that much power. The worst that would happen is like some crumbling, a few older houses get demolished, maybe some cracks in the ground, like nothing like in the movie at all. It would be bad, but it wouldn't be that bad.
Speaking of bad, I was perusing the Shout Factory website and came across a horror movie from 1974, I think.
Oh, no.
1976. It's called Squirm. Have either of you seen it?
No.
Oh, the cover. I like horror movies, but the cover has scarred me. It's a picture of a
guy
with worms burrowing into his face.
Oh, no.
It's
no.
So bad.
I looked at it. Don't look at it.
I'm not going to.
It's so bad. The premise is just so silly. And it got really bad score on IMDb, but apparently it's a classic horror movie.
Electricity from downed power lines.
When a powerful storm knocks Fly Creek, George's power lines down onto wet soil, the resulting surge of electricity drives large, bloodthirsty worms to the surface. And then, out of their soil...
I'm sorry.
And the then, out of the soil-tilling mines, soon the townspeople discover that their sleepy fishing village is overrun with worms that burrow right into their skin. Inundated by hundreds of thousands of carnivorous creatures, the terrorized locals race to find the cause of the rampage before becoming...
Tilled?
T-I-L-L-E-D. Is that tilled?
Tiled? What? Like soiled?
Tilled.
Tilled. Yeah.
Tilled means
like
prepare
to prepare the
and
dirt.
Cultivate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Before they become tilled
time.
Under themselves.
Oh no.
Huh. Well. I don't even know what to say.
Oh God, I found stills. It's
why
so
are you doing this to yourself?
I don't know. It's so dumb. They don't even look like worms. They're like garter snakes or something.
Ugh. I'm not clicking on.
No, don't click on it. But I'm not Alex doing it. Can click on it.
I know. I'm looking at it. Imagine that guy's like walks into a party. He's like, "Do I have something on my face?"
Not doing it.
No. It's bad.
I do not suffer from a morbid sense of curiosity, so I'll just be over here, not looking.
It's probably for the best.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen the 1970s Captain America movie?
No.
I have not, but I think I recall it vaguely.
Whatever you do, don't watch it now.
Oh, I imagine it doesn't hold up. I don't feel like most superhero movies from the 70s and 80s have held up.
Yeah, it's doubtful. It's like superhero movies didn't really get good until the Marvel Cinematic Universe, really. Because, like, what was there before that? The Daredevil
movie? Well,
actually,
I really enjoyed, and I just watched it again this week, and I really enjoyed Blade 2. That movie still holds up.
Those were good, actually.
Well, the thing is the first one was kind of okay. Third one was a travesty. The second one, you can actually just watch Blade 2 without watching any of the others in the series and still understand what is going on, because the first few seconds of Blade 2, like, talks about, you know, I'm the Daywalker. This is who I am. This is what I do. This is what I'm trying to do, kind of thing. So, and it gets that out of the way quickly. I'm surprised at how some of those special effects still hold up for a 14-year-old movie. I mean, this came out in 2002, and like the effects were when Blade shoots a vampire and they like burn up and explode, that still looks pretty decent.
Well, the effect on Buffy still looks pretty decent as well. Maybe it's just a thing about vampire destruction, like when she stakes them and they collapse into a skeleton and then dust. Looks pretty good still.
Buffy.
You haven't seen Buffy?
I didn't have a TV in the later seasons. It was like, oh, well, I could buy it on DVD, but I didn't have the money to do that. And now that it's on Netflix, my husband doesn't like Buffy, which I know is like sacrilege, but my husband doesn't like Buffy. So, and since we both work from home and we're both together all the time, it's really hard to find time to watch TV he doesn't like.
Oh, no. Oh, God, that's horrible.
I just sent you some Captain America photos, 1979.
Oh, the side profile.
It's actually better than I thought it would look.
The side profile on the bike. Oh, no.
It's so bad.
So much bulge.
Yeah. Oh, God.
They had to have padded that or not. I don't know.
Not even.
I don't know.
I'm just going to keep an itty-bitty view of that, so I don't see.
And I like the see-through Captain America shield on the front of the bike. That's a nice detail.
I'm going to find a picture of Red Skull, because he looks so terrible. Okay, be prepared.
Oh,
here's a comparison of the original Red Skull to the one from the first Avenger. I've been sitting in the sun all day. Look at my skin.
Oh, my God. He looks so happy.
Oh, no.
And waterproof.
Yeah. That is some serious vinyl
action. Kids, this is what happens when you don't moisturize.
Or wear sunscreen.
I did not see that coming.
I was just thinking that he doesn't look very menacing to me either.
Neither of them do, really.
Well, the original one, the guy on the left, he kind of looks more like a burn victim rather than a guy that's being transformed.
He looks pretty happy. He's got smiling eyes.
Well, he's got his hands on his hip. Like, I'm happy to be here.
He's smizing.
We should wrap this up
on
that terrible, terrible image.
And we will be posting links to all of these images for your viewing pleasure, or not.
Yay, show notes.
Oh, they're bad. Don't look at them.
Embrace the awfulness.
And on that note, thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Impromptu. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to leave a rating on iTunes and let your friends know about us. Detailed show notes for each episode are available on our website at theimpromptu.net. You can follow the show on Twitter at theimpromptu, as well as our hosts individually at Zen Impulse for Michael Norton and at Zero Distraction for Alex Knight. As we are entirely listener-supported, you can donate to us at theimpromptu.net/donate. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth as well as equipment upgrades to uphold the highest level of audio quality you've come to expect. We really do appreciate your support, and we look forward to seeing you next time.